Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by...
Hi, I'm Scott Hahn, and I'd like to invite you personally to join me and Breadbox Media on August 24th in New Oxford, Pennsylvania, for a day of spiritual renewal. I'll be presenting three talks, one on St. Joseph, one on the sacrament of matrimony, and another one on the Holy Eucharist. Learn more and register at breadboxmedia.com/PA conference. I hope to see you there.
Celebrate our God-given freedom and faith while honoring our Blessed Mother with Ghirelli's USA Rosary. Each state is represented on this rosary's 50 beads. Red, white, and blue enamel adorn its patriotic crucifix. Get yours today. Shop www.ghirelli.com.
And good evening. Welcome to Beneath the Surface here at WCAP Radio. Glad you could join us tonight. Beneath the Surface, where faith and reason meets every Monday evening between 10 and 11 p.m., where truth, life, and love are one, bringing a little sanity into our age of insanity, a little life into our culture of death. We are here on WCAP, live, and then on podcast. On archive.com, Podbean, Breadbox Media, iTunes, iHeart, and perhaps a few others of which I am unaware. Before I tell you about my show tonight, which is actually a part two, right across from me, Mr. John Tudorus, welcome Beneath the Surface again.
Hey.
How you doing?
Feeling good.
Fantastic. We have a great show tonight, as you know.
Yes, we do.
And why don't I introduce that show right now. Tonight we are going part two with our interview with Dr. Janet Smith, author of Contraception, Why Not? Humanae Vitae, A Generation Later, Why Humanae Vitae Was Right, and other wonderful works that we will talk about later on in the show. She is a professor of moral theology at Sacred Heart Major Seminary in Detroit. Last show, we talked about the effects, basically, on women, on relationships, and on the world. And today, part two, we're going to talk a little more specifically about what I consider the most important document written in modern times, and that is Humanae Vitae by Pope Paul VI. Dr. Janet Smith, are you with us?
I'm right here.
Oh, fantastic. That is good to hear. Welcome, Beneath the Surface.
It's good to be here again.
So, Dr. Smith, last show, I just want to give perhaps a one-minute quick recap of what we did. And if you remember that I forgot something, please feel free to jump in. Last week we talked about what contraception does to women's health. It increases the chance of breast cancer. Infertility. I'm not sure if we talked about this, but at least in the heavier dose pills, it also increases the chance of a stroke and a heart attack. We talked about how it affects pheromones, those invisible things that our olfactory nerves are apparently we're able to smell without really being conscious of it. But it's very important when it comes to relationships because, as we talked about last week, women on the pill, their libido is less, and because their system is mimicked as if they are pregnant, that's what the pill does to the female system, so too then our men have less attraction to women that are on the pill. Women have attraction to genetically similar people, as well as less masculine men. So the pill sort of messes with your attraction system, if you will, and your potential mate selection. We also talked about how the birth control pills act as an abortifacient, that they act as a backup when contraception, which is this primary mechanism, fails, which does happen a few percentage, if I'm not mistaken, a few percentage points for every woman on the pill. The hormonal components of the pill make the uterine lining, the endometrium, hostile for the tiny embryo who is conceived to attach to, like it naturally is supposed to. And the theory is that tiny human beings are flushed out of the women's bodies without them even realizing it. So it acts as an abortifacient. We talked about how the hormonal pills are now being found in the oceans. They are actually feminizing fish, and there seems to be some indication that it is also affecting human beings in a way that perhaps is feminizing men, and this may be another added problem when it comes to infertility today, and the problem of infertility. We talked a little bit about the language of the body, that that when you give your total and whole self, which is the marital act, you are actually saying one thing: I give you my whole self permanently and completely without reservation. But contraception actually makes that self-donation, that self-communication, a lie, because you actually aren't. You're holding back on one of the more important parts of yourself, and that is your fertility. And I believe that's somewhat of a recap of what we went over last week. If you can remember the show, would you like to add anything else?
You know, I don't remember much of it. My life is just one blur of humani vitae, but I think I was amazed at what you just said. It sounds like something I said in the last week somewhere.
Yeah, you did, and it was a great show, too, by the way. I'm sure you must have so many, because let me just tell the audience, as we broadcast from a private, actually a public radio station, WCAP. It's not a Catholic station. It's not a Christian station. So the reason why Dr. Smith is so busy lately is because the encyclical Humanae Vitae is experiencing its 50th birthday, its 50th anniversary, which is actually on July 25th. So, on that note, why don't we begin part two, perhaps talking a little bit more directly about this encyclical that we've been talking about for so long, and that is Humanae Vitae. Why don't you, Dr. Smith, give us a little historical context of why it happened and why it was so important?
Well, it's a very, as you said, it's probably the most important document of the Church. Certainly for the last century, though John Paul II wrote some pretty dynamite documents, there's no question about it. But nothing has had the effect on the Church and the world as did Humanae Vitae. I was 18 when it came out, and I much didn't know it was happening. I don't know that I even remember it happening. But to put it in the context, it wasn't that this wasn't the first time that the Church all of a sudden pronounced this teaching, right? It had been something that all Christian churches had taught up until 1930. All Christian churches had opposed contraception, believing it was not in accord with God's plan for fertility.
Yeah.
And most Christian churches were not Catholic, and they believed this honestly on some values that were put forward in Scripture, that God is a God that loves life. When he blesses people, he gives them nations of people, as many as the stars in the sky and the sands on the seashore.
So for almost 2,000 years, all of Christianity was on the same page that contraception was a serious sin. That's Eastern Orthodoxy as well as the world of Protestantism.
That's absolutely right. And for the first time in 1930, the Anglican Church broke with the unbroken tradition and said that for serious reasons, spouses within marriage could use contraception. They did very little for giving reasons. It was, again, a lot of it was a certain compassion that women were having lots of children, and it was difficult to keep up with them, and thinking that contraception would help that picture. there weren't that many contraceptives available. You're largely talking about the condom and the diaphragm and withdrawal. The pill wasn't invented until the late 1950s. And that's part of the impetus, if you would, for Humanae Vitae, not so directly speaking, but when the pill was invented, as we mentioned last time, it works by suppressing a woman's ovulation system. And if a woman is not ovulating, she can't get pregnant. And it suppresses her ovulation system by putting in her body synthetic forms of the hormones she would have in her body when she's pregnant. So she's in a state of pseudo-pregnancy when she is using a contraceptive. And it was very clever of Planned Parenthood and the others that were pushing to discover a form of contraception to make it a medical thing. Up to that point, you know, the condom and the diaphragm were just devices that were sold really close to the pornographic stuff in a drugstore or a store. It was not considered to be a respectable thing. These were things that you largely used with a mistress or a prostitute, but not with your wife, again, until the Anglicans made a turn there. That was in 1930. In that same year, Pius XI put out a beautiful document called Casti Connubii, Chaste Marriages, or On Christian Marriage. Beautiful document. And he just made a sort of response to the Anglicans and laid out the beautiful vision of the Catholic Church and, as you said, Christians up to that time about marriage. And there was no debate about this issue in the Catholic Church, none. There weren't theologians saying we should go the way of the Anglicans, we really need to get up to speed with the other Christian churches. Most of the other Christian churches followed along. But the Catholic Church almost didn't blink an eye at the whole situation. It wasn't until, again, the pill was invented. And the pill was, again, invented by medical doctors. And it was now considered to be something, you know, that you were prescribed by a doctor. Yeah. You know, most of us know you're not prescribed things by doctors except when you're ill. So it started to make pregnancy sound like it was a kind of an illness, something that it wasn't healthy to be. You had to go to a doctor to get this pill to prevent it.
Yeah.
The pill was very different from the condom and the diaphragm because those had to be used in proximity of the sexual act. And they were called, and it's very interesting that they fall under the category of being barriers. Right, the condom and the diaphragm are barrier methods. And I've always thought that's an interesting concept, that you're going to have sex with someone, but you have to get your barrier in place. And, of course,
right,
the diaphragm uses a spermicide. You say, well, that's a nice thing. A spermicide means killing the sperm. So you're going to have sex with a man, but you're so hostile to his sperm that you want to kill it.
Yeah.
Well, the pill, go ahead.
No, I was just agreeing with you, yes.
Yeah. Well, then the pill, of course, was, it seemed medicine. You take it, and it was viewed that maybe it's different from the barrier forms because it's not a barrier. And it may be something that's legitimate because it could just be extending the infertility that a woman has in her system. But as I described it, it doesn't do just that. A woman's natural infertility is because her body has this cycle where it's preparing for a pregnancy. If a pregnancy doesn't happen, then her body gets a kind of a chance to rest from the whole preparation again of producing a whole endometrium that's ready to receive a new little fertilized ovum, a new little embryonic human being. The woman's body does that every month, and it's quite the task to build up this whole endometrium, and then if it doesn't get pregnant, she bleeds for a couple days. So the fertility that we have is one that's in service of putting our bodies at rest. But the infertility that the pill gave us was one of deceiving the body into thinking that it was pregnant, actually putting it again into a state of pseudo-pregnancy, which is not really so much a state of rest. It's a state of bizarreness, you might say. Well, the theologians took a look at the pill and decided, yes, it falls under the church's condemnation of contraception because it's intended to try to help couples have sex when they may conceive a child and prevent them from conceiving a child. So it's very hostile to new life. It's hostile to God's plan for sex. It's saying we want to have sex on our own terms. We want to have sex that it does not involve a procreative possibility.
Yeah. It's interesting how you had mentioned that this was first proposed as healthcare.
And it seems to be doing just the opposite. It's healthy functioning to become pregnant. The term use protection is sort of a just makes literally it makes no sense because you are protecting yourself from healthy functioning.
Yes, exactly right. I mean, it's the women and men who are infertile that need medical treatment.
Right.
They're the ones that need to be brought back to a healthy condition.
Exactly.
That being for a woman to have fertile and infertile cycles is absolutely natural. And if she's not, it really means that there's something not right with her system. That usually does mean some sort of nutritional deficiency, because it's the nutrition that we put into our system that produces the hormones that cause these cycles to happen. So if a woman's not having the cycles or the right kind of cycles, it really means there's some sort of deficiency in her system of hormones. And so what was happening, though, in the 60s was a sense that the world was becoming extremely overpopulated. And the pill was greeted as this huge savior of mankind, that it was we'd be able to really, as we are, basically dropping it from the sky on third world countries and reducing population growth. And the UN was gearing up for all sorts of programs where they were going to distribute contraceptives to third world countries. And they were, of course, very much trying to persuade the Catholic Church to come along, persuade the Catholic Church to give up on its condemnation.
And this was the 1960s? Is that where we are, the 1960s at this point?
We're still in the early 1960s, right after the pill was invented. It was very clear that there were those who were trying to, again, push the pill. They thought, whoa, this is really the answer to so many problems, and particularly the problem of overpopulation.
So from 1930 to 1960, and this is a generalization, but beginning with the Anglicans, you would say that virtually every other Christian denomination fell to the contraceptive mentality, allowing it, except for the Catholic Church.
Right. It's much like the Catholic Church is pretty much alone. I mean, the evangelicals have come along very far with the Catholic Church to fight abortion and to fight same-sex marriages. But the pressure's on the Church. Get with the modern world.
Exactly.
And the Anglican Church has accepted both of those. And so the Catholic Church has sort of stood as a bulwark against this total modernizing of the church.
And Humani Vitae was meant to be sort of a dam for the you know upcoming waters of the world, if you will, to keep it out. But we need to take a quick break, Dr. Smith, for a couple of commercials. But because of the invention of the pill, Pope Paul VI decided that it was time to write an encyclical. And we'll talk a little bit about that after we take this quick break. You're listening to Beneath the Surface with Paul Morano here at WCAP Radio. My guest tonight is Dr. Janet Smith, and we will be right back. We are back. Back are we. Beneath the Surface here at WCAP 980 on your dial. Thanks for joining us tonight. Part two of our interview with Dr. Janet Smith, contraception, why not? And we're talking about the encyclical Humanae Vitae tonight. John, what do you think of the conversation so far?
Actually, I like it.
Yeah, am I doing okay?
I think you're doing very good. I also like it how.
See, I don't want to try. I don't want to interrupt her. You know, she's on a roll. But sometimes I need to tell her that there's a commercial and so forth.
No. I think it's great. In fact, what I really like is how Dr. Smith just lets it go. And,
yes.
Because most people tend to want to dance around a bit and actually you really don't get very far that way. But if you lay out the facts. And just let the truth speak for herself.
Well, this is one of the most politically incorrect things we're talking about tonight.
Oh, goodness, yeah.
And, of course, it's where the devil has a stronghold because it's the very foundation of our culture of death today.
So put those two things together, and you've got yourself a courageous lady on the other side of this line.
Yeah, the abortion epidemic has its roots in the contraceptive mentality. There's no question.
978-454-4980 if you want to get a hold of us to join the conversation with Dr. Janet Smith. 978-454-4980. Okay, Dr. Smith, I begrudgingly have to move us along a little bit because we don't want to make the same mistake as we did last week and run out of time in half of what we wanted to say. So why don't we, you provided a good context as to why Humanae Vitae was necessary. So Pope Paul VI, representing, of course, the Catholic Church, wrote this encyclical. And I'd like to focus first on section 14 and then after that on section 17.
I'm going to waylay you just a little bit.
Please do.
If you don't mind. I'm going to start at the beginning.
Good.
All right?
Yes.
Because I wrote actually a pamphlet for the Our Sunday Visitor Foundation that people can find online, that they're just, you know, that churches can put in the back of the church and people can buy it and give it to their friends and family. But anyway, this, I don't know if I mentioned last time, but I actually retranslated Humanae Vitae.
I think you did mention that.
Did I mention that?
I think so, yeah.
Did we talk about the term munus?
Yes, we did.
Okay, well then maybe we don't need to go back to this, but let me just introduce this for people who didn't hear us last time or just review.
Okay.
That the vision of Humanae Vitae is really that God, as the first line says, has entrusted spouses with the extremely important mission of transmitting human life. Right? So he's given, as I mentioned last time, he's given the Pope the gift or the mission of infallibility. He's given bishops the mission of consecrating priests. Priests the mission of consecrating the sacraments. Mary the mission of being the mother of God. Christ himself as being priest, prophet, and king, having a threefold mission. But to spouses, he's given the mission of transmitting human life. And the phrase transmitting life is kind of a strange phrase. We transmit over the airways, and to think about transmitting life, it's kind of shocking, and there might be a better word, but in a sense, you want it to be strange. Because God has to be present in each and every act of making a new human being. That the sperm does not have an immortal soul, and the egg does not have an immortal soul, so it can only come from God. So God creates each and every new human soul individually.
The parents provide the matter, and God infuses the soul simultaneously with that matter at conception. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly right.
Okay.
And so that every time a couple is engaging in sexual intercourse during a time that might be fertile, they're basically inviting God to create a new human soul and saying, we will accept this as the great gift that you mean it to be. God, it's a great gift that God has given to humans, but humans are also providing, as Humanae Vitae says, they're rendering a service to God, the Creator. Right? They're helping God out. God wants to populate heaven, and he can't do it unless human beings fall in love and make a lifetime commitment to each other and have children. So that's how the document begins, all right? And then it goes into some of the problems. The first one actually is that there's a rapid increase in population, and what are we going to do about it? And it talks about feminism in a sense, that women are having a new role in the public space. So isn't it fair then to allow couples to use contraception?
Yeah.
And then it says that haven't we been able to control nature in all sorts of ways? We put planes in the air. Why shouldn't we allow the use of contraception? So it acknowledges all sorts of problems that there are in the modern world, but then again it returns to what an incredibly special thing it is to be able to be a parent with another person, and how being a parent with another person really does actually, you know, make real this commitment to have a lifetime relationship. If you have a baby with another person, you are always going to be in a lifetime relationship with that person.
That's right.
And so when you're having sex with a person during a fertile time, you're basically saying to this person, I am open to having, and I want to have, a lifetime relationship with you. So that's the context of the document. So I'll let you go on to section 14. But I just wanted to put us in there in that context.
Okay. Humanae Vitae 14 is, it seems like it's basically the authoritative parts of Humanae Vitae, and it says that, quote, "We are obliged once more to declare that the direct interruption of the generative process already begun, and above all, direct abortion, even for therapeutic reasons, are to be absolutely excluded as lawful means of regulating the number of children one has." Then it goes on to say, and I won't quote it, but equally to be condemned is contraception as well as sterilization. And with the authoritative language that it uses, it is basically saying they are never lawful. You can never do evil in order that good might come out of it, quoting Romans chapter 3, verse 8. And that any of these interruptive impeding of the human life process, when you intentionally impede its natural end, is intrinsically evil or intrinsically wrong, which means there is no consequence, or no circumstances or intention that could make it a good act. Your thoughts?
What did you ask a question?
My question was your thoughts.
My thoughts. Yes. It's honestly, that's very good to pick out 14. 14 really does say something about it expands on the teaching, but it's really laid out in section 12. All right?
Yeah.
I'm going to read my translation. It says the doctrine, it's really section 11. No, it's all these sections. Let's go to section 11.
Hmm.
"The marital acts by which spouses intimately and chastely unite and by which human life is transmitted, as the recent council reiterated, are good and worthy of human dignity." So the marital acts, sexual acts, allow spouses to intimately and chastely unite.
Marital sex is good.
I think I mentioned last time that our culture thinks of sex as being just sex, and mostly thinks about sex as being naughty, because we think about sex as being in the context of pornography for the most part.
Hmm.
And then all the many diverse ways that people engage in sex in our culture that are way beyond and not at all the chaste sexual intercourse of couples within marriage.
Yeah.
That sexual intercourse rises almost to kind of some sort of a sacred act, all right, a sacramental act.
Yes.
Where the spouses are doing something that God really wants them to do, which is making an expression of love that is a commitment to a lifetime relationship. And as it says here, these are the acts by which human life is transmitted. And it says marital acts do not cease being legitimate if the spouses are aware that they are infertile for reasons not voluntarily caused by them. So when the spouses know that they're infertile at the first 10 days of the month or so, and then they're infertile for the last 12 days of the month, there's nothing wrong with having sex during that time. Because it says, these acts remain ordained to expressing and strengthening the union of the spouses. God said to couples, you can have sexual intercourse all month long, when you're fertile and when you're infertile. It's all fine with me. Right, so that's what it's saying here, because you're expressing your love. And he wants spouses to express their love. Again, our culture doesn't think about the sexual act as being an expression of love. They think of it as seeking pleasure.
Imagine that.
Right? Now, and great pleasure obviously comes from the act, but the act is meant to say, I want to do something with greatly pleasurable with you that I do only with you. Right, only with you, with no one else. And I understand that this is an act by which new life could be created.
Yeah,
that's immensely important.
It's the act
enjoying milkshake together.
Absolutely, it's the act as Scripture says. It's the act where two become one flesh. You are truly united.
Two becomes one flesh,
yeah.
And in other documents, there's even a sense that people become one in soul.
Yes,
right. That this union is so tight. It's not just a fleshly union. It's a personal union. And again, and why is it a personal union? Because you're giving of the possibility of being a parent with this other person. And that engages everything about your personhood, your responsibility, your generosity, your patience, your ability to plan for this future, your ability to be self-sacrificing. So all of that comes into this act.
But wouldn't you say that it's deeply personal also if the couple happens to be infertile? It's still a deeply personal union?
Absolutely. But because the acts, it's strange to say that they, just because they can't actualize their potency, just because they can't produce a new human life, doesn't mean that's not the kind of act that they are. All right. Yeah. This, even people who aren't, the sexual act is a kind of act because it involves exchange of sperm and exchange of egg. Is meant to be a life that can bring forth new human beings. So that's what the act is attempting to do, even if it can't do it because of some defect in a person's system or age. All right, people who are old enough don't have eggs anymore. But the act itself is still one that says that. It's the kind of act that says that. All right, it's a procreative kind of act, right, even if it's not an act that actually results in a child.
Yeah, unfortunately, we have a lot of people who perhaps aren't deep thinkers that would say, well, if the church says that it's good to have marital sex after menopause, then what's wrong with homosexual sex?
Well, because their ex can't possibly say that. They can't possibly say, the ex of couples, even when they're infertile, are right. It's a bit strange to say, but it basically says, it still says, I want to be yours forever. And I'm engaging in the kind of act that could produce children, and that's how it says that. That's how it makes the act say, I want to be with you forever. But the sexual acts of homosexuals have no procreative possibility with them.
Right.
None. And so it's not like it can symbolize a relationship. It can't in any way speak that language of complete self-giving. Because you're both giving the same thing. You're both giving sperm, and I don't know if you would call what lesbians do is giving eggs, but it's you can't even engage in an act that has a procreative possibility there.
You can't go beyond yourself with these acts. It's like two plugs or two outlets trying to get together to create electricity.
Right.
It just doesn't happen.
Right.
Just to give an analogy. Okay, so then the marital sexual act is good, holy, and it is meant for deep personal union, not just bodily union, not just soul union, but both, to continue the deepening of that two becoming one flesh. And its natural end in healthy, fertile people is the possibility of procreation. And there you have what Pope Paul VI introduced as the unitive and the procreative meanings of marital love.
Yeah, he goes into that quite a bit in section 12, where it says, the doctrine of the magisterium of the church has often explained is this, there is an unbreakable connection between the unitive meaning and the procreative meaning of the marital act, and both are inherent in the marital act. This connection was established by God, and human beings are not permitted to break it through their own volition.
Mm.
Therefore, because of its intrinsic nature, the marital act which unites husband and wife with the closest of bonds also makes them capable of bringing forth new life according to the laws written into their very natures as male and female. And if both essential meanings are preserved, that of union and procreation, the marital act fully maintains its capacity for fostering true mutual love and its ordination to the highest mission of parenthood to which human beings are called. So again, they say this is the way God has made things. God has made men and women, and made He wants there to be new life, and He made new life to come about through the loving act of spouses. And say this is written right into our being. And when we decide we want to have sex but not have babies, when we're willing to violate the good of our bodies, we are really saying that again we want to do what we want to do rather than what God wants us to do.
Right. It's interesting how sex, or marital sex, is both love-giving and life-giving. And in God, even Scripture attests to the fact that God is both love and life. In fact, in God, they are one, aren't they? They're never to be separated.
Exactly right. And what does... I mean, when you think... It's interesting what Aristotle thought. I don't know if you... In ancient philosophy,
yeah.
Aristotle said that God was the prime mover. And he asked, you know, like, what does God do all the time? And he said that God is thought, thinking, thought.
Right.
God thinks all the time. And what does he think about? he thinks about himself, because why would he think about any, he's the perfect thing. And why would the perfect thing spend any time thinking about anything that's imperfect? Mm. So what does God do for eternity? He's thought, thinking, thought. Well, the Christian God is a triune God, three persons who are united by love. And what do what does the triune God do for an eternity? Well, it loves.
Yeah.
And what does love do? Love overflows. It's the very nature of love to be diffusive of itself. It's the nature of the good to give. I mean, if you ever know loving people, they just give and give and give. They always act like they're at your disposal. How can I help? What can I do for you? As if they have no concerns of their own. I travel a lot, and you know, people host me. I'm always astonished at these people, that they somehow are dropping. It's like they don't have a life, except that their life is there to serve me. And I know they've got bills to pay, and I know they've got crises in their life, and I know they have phone calls to answer and everything. Mm. But they're acting as though, I'm here to serve you, and I'm here to give you whatever you need. What do you need? And that's God. God is life, and he's love, and he's always giving. So to perform the sexual act without allowing at least a retention of the meaning of giving and of new life in this act is to close it down and make it very selfish, as opposed to something that is unselfish and always giving, putting yourself at the service of the other person. I mean, how many people in our culture still, you know, go into the sexual act? It's, well, how much pleasure can I get out of this?
Gosh, a lot of them.
And it's not even meant to be an act of how much pleasure can I give. What you're really supposed to be trying to do is affirming the other person and saying to the other person, you are so special. You are so wonderful. And I want to engage in this act with you, which allows me in a very intimate, vulnerable way, a very private way that involves nobody else but the two of us, to show you how much I love you. And so it's such an amazing act, whereas our culture is just sort of, you know, pleasure, 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 and no thought of expressing love, expressing commitment, expressing affirmation.
It's amazing. And I just want to go back a little bit about the notion that love is Trinitarian in its nature, because God is love. It's interesting how love, by its very nature, is relational. And this is one reason how we can understand that God is love, because God is tripersonal. And in that tripersonhood, God is, in a sense, lover, beloved, and love, which is the love between the lover and beloved. And as many of the great Catholic philosophers have been writing about in the past few decades, this is etched into our own being, that we are meant to be harbingers of this Trinitarian love, and how it's reflected is the human family, that the man or the father can be seen as lover of his beloved spouse, and the love between them, sometimes, as Kimberly Hahn once said, you have to name it 9 months later. That triadic Trinitarian nature of love itself is right there, and if you try to contracept that, you're not really, you don't have love at all. Like you said, it goes automatically, it goes inwardly, and all you're left with is selfishness and abuse. Objectively speaking.
Yeah, objectively, you're not really uniting. I mean, and it becomes such a reality. In our culture, with contraception, people think it's okay to have sex with just about anybody for almost any reason. Right? Because it's no big deal. There's no procreative possibility. And so people think, why can't I have sex with this person? Why do I have to be married? Why can't I do this? Blah, blah, blah. Because sex is no big deal. It's just, you know, rubbing parts together. Whereas the church says, no, sex is a very big deal. You're engaging in an act that God has ordained to uniting the two of you in this profound love, and allowing you to express this love, and allowing this love then to become a new human being. And so the procreative possibility is not something that is a threat. It's something that really makes this act so profoundly meaningful. And so the world just thinks about sex as just sex. The church thinks about sex as, again, this huge gift, this huge mission that God has entrusted to spouses. And it's almost like having sex outside of marriage is a kind of blasphemy. It's like using the Eucharistic bread for something else. You know, it's like saying, well, we want to have a party, and let's just go to the tabernacle and take the host and just pass it around to anybody that you want to do and sprinkle some sprinkles on it or something and eat it. And you say, that's not what it's about.
Yeah.
And so having sex outside of marriage and doing all and contracepting sex is a kind of a defamation of a sacred thing.
Amazing. It's interesting how the modern world has no appreciation for the procreative aspects of sex, but also, I believe, has no real appreciation of the unitive aspect of sex, that the fact that there is a permanent bonding mechanism that occurs, and I think we talked about this a little bit last week with all of the hormones that occur and the coming together of the genetic material and the two bodies and all of that that produces, by its very nature, a permanent bonding between people. And it's no coincidence that traditionally it is the act that consummates and makes unbreakable marriage.
Yeah, it's much worth thinking about.
Yeah. Do you want to go to Humana Vitae 17? Because we're sort of getting close to the end here.
No, I don't. I want to go, because that's, we actually, aren't I just terrible, but we sort of did 17 last time. 17 is the predictions, and we did a lot of the consequences. I want to go to section, I think it's 21.
All right,
let's go to 21.
Let's do it.
Listen, yeah, go there. All right, because we haven't talked a lot about natural family planning.
Importance.
It's spoken of much earlier in the document. It's something that God is totally in accord with God's plan for sexuality. Again, couples can have sex anytime during the month. And so to have sex while you're infertile is fine. To have sex, not have sex when you're fertile is fine. And we're supposing that the couple has made a very conscientious decision prayerfully with God, with each other and God, and said to God, you know, we think having another child right now would be an undue burden for us in this household now. And, you know, the document says it can be for financial reasons, psychological reasons, social reasons, physical reasons, health, money, whatever, depression, whatever. It's not whatever, but any one of those categories. And it has to be for serious reasons, not just, you know, that you're just, you know, you just got the card detailed. It's filthy again, whatever, you
right,
know.
Sure.
And you say, okay. So God says, fine, if you don't think it's a good idea to have a child, and I agree with you, then don't have sex during the fertile time, because that's when you could have a child, right? I take it as an invitation to create a soul. And if you don't want to issue an invitation, don't have sex during the fertile time. But there's no reason, and there's good reason, to have sex during the infertile time. I want you to enjoy each other and give each other during that time. Then there's other great things that come from natural family planning, especially in our culture where most people have had sex before marriage.
Mm.
And again, they've come to think of sex as a casual thing and, as I've been talking, as just sex, no big deal. And how can you go from thinking of sex being just sex and no big deal to into marriage and now thinking this is something only between us, it's this great and marvelous thing? Well, one way you can do that is when you use natural family planning, you have to relearn yet to think about sex entirely differently. You have to learn how the church thinks about it, right? That's what enables you to abstain and to abstain when you need to abstain, which is hard. It's like dieting, or it's like budgeting, or it's like exercising regularly.
Yep.
Churches, people say NFP is hard, and I said, and so?
that means it's good, usually.
Yeah. Yeah, but it brings benefits. And one of the big benefits, again, is it brings what John Paul II talks about is self-mastery. So in section 21, it says, moral family planning, that's natural family planning, requires that spouses recognize and value the true goods of life and the family, that their sex is in service of the family and not just themselves. And also they acquire the habit of complete mastery of themselves and their desires. In order to control the drives of nature, the spouses need to become self-denying through their using reason and free will. Only then will the manifestations of love appropriate for marriage couples be what they ought to be. Self-mastery is especially necessary for those who practice periodic abstention. And I mean, John Paul II, in several places in his works, says that if you have self-mastery over your sexual desires, you're going to be a better lover, right? And why are you going to be a better lover? Well, a lot of people, it's just people eat compulsively, all right? People, let's talk about eating compulsively. You're bored or you're tired or, you know, you just want some amusement and you eat. Yep. And you don't usually eat junk food. Now, in all over the world, take Italy or France, there's beautiful people and they know how to eat beautifully, right? They master their desires and they eat only really good food. So he's saying within marriage, if you have control over your sexual appetites, it's not that you're just sort of grabbing your spouse because you've got a powerful sexual physical need, but now you can master that. And now you can say, I'm going to have sex with my spouse when it's good for my spouse and when it's good for both of us. And it's not just going to be, I'm going to be pestering my spouse because I have a physical need. Instead, I know how to control that need, and I now know how to put it in service of the family.
Yeah, and you could say it also shows respect for women's body ecology and its rhythms. So it brings you closer together as a couple.
Absolutely. And then it goes on to say in the next paragraph that it's good for the family. It says, truly discipline of this sort, from which marital chastity shines forth, cannot be an obstacle to love. Rather, discipline imbues love with a deeper human meaning. Although self-control requires continuous effort, it also helps the spouses become strong in virtue and makes them rich with spiritual goods. And this virtue fosters the fruits of tranquility and peace in the home and helps in the solving of difficulties of other kinds. It aids spouses in becoming more tender with each other and more attentive to each other. Because as their sexual lives become less selfish, they become less selfish, and they say, I'm meant to be affirming this person, not crabbing at them all the time, not criticizing all the time, but affirming them, right? That's the sexual act is meant to be that, and it should spill over into the rest of life.
Yeah.
It says, it assists them in dispelling that inordinate self-love that is opposed to true charity. It strengthens them in awareness of their responsibilities. And finally, it provides parents with a sure and efficacious authority for educating their children. As their children advance through life, they will come to a correct appreciation of true human goods and employ peacefully and properly the powers of their mind and senses. Now, most of us as adults have done many things that we hadn't done when we were younger. And there's a sort of question like, how are we going to tell your kids not to do what you did? That's a problem for parents. But you think, you know, if we're practicing natural family planning, if we're getting control over our sexual desires, we're doing what we expect our kids to do. We expect them to say no to sex when they're 14, 15, 16, 17. They may have powerful sexual desires, maybe more powerful than our sexual desires. And somehow we expect them to say no. Well, if we expect them to say no, then we need to learn how to say no.
So important.
Yes, so important.
I don't think, you could never have a healthy marriage if you weren't, if there wasn't self-discipline involved in it. But as you were reading that section 21 of Humanae Vitae, and how it, how it strengthens marriage, that incredible statistic came into my head that's been said many times, and I've looked, I've did a little research on it, and I believe it is true, that even though today, partly because of contraception, almost 50% of marriages end in divorce, less than 2% of all marriages that use natural family planning instead of contraception end in divorce. An amazing stat, is it not?
It's an amazing stat, though I'm afraid it might be changing a bit. It depends on how the question gets asked. As always, questions get asked. I was just talking to some much, much younger people who work with couples, and they say that porn is starting to penetrate into couples who use natural family planning. That men think that when at times of abstention, they can look at porn. And sometimes their wives think that that's not a bad idea either. And it's so wrong-headed, and it just shows to show you they haven't been transformed. They haven't got the transformation that living by the church's teaching on sexuality is supposed to bring. Yeah. Because, I mean, pornography is so disrespectful, certainly to a man's wife. What is he doing? He's filling, purposely filling his head with images of other women and thinking of other women sexually, right? When a man should be trying to shut that down whenever it occurs. Not encourage it, but shut it down.
Right.
And say, I want all my sexual thoughts to be about my wife. I want all my sexual desires to be directed towards my wife. That's the way I honor her.
Yeah.
I want it to be, the reason I want it to my wife is because I want sex and love to be together. I want sex and love to be together. I don't want to separate them. If I'm thinking about these other women, there's no love involved. It's just sex. And not to mention the degradation that those women have gone through to become a part of pornographic movies or pictures. And so porn kills love. It absolutely kills love. Yeah. It's completely incompatible with love.
There's a great website called fightthenewdrug.org that says a lot about that. Dr. Mm-hmm. Smith, we only have 2 minutes left, and I know you wanted to promote some of your new works. Do you want to talk about that a little bit with your 2 minutes? Or?
Well, thank you very much. Yes, I have a new book out, which is actually it's a compilation of my scholarly articles. So people who have had a little bit of theological background, it's not that it's totally inaccessible to the lay Catholic, but it's called Self-Gift, and it's a collection of already published articles on Humana Vitae and the thought of John Paul II.
Okay.
Ignatius Press is bringing out, on the anniversary of Humana Vitae, a volume called Why Humana Vitae is Still Right.
Mm.
They published with me a volume 25 years ago called Why Humana Vitae is Right, a Reader. And that was a collection of essays written by me and a lot of other people. And it's kind of it covers all sorts of different topics that are relevant to this by people who are experts in the field. And so it's been 25 years since that book, and a lot of things have happened, among them theology of the body, all sorts of other things, homosexuality, transgenderism, much more knowledge about hormones. So this book doesn't really replace that book, but it answers the new concerns that we have, and it's called Why Humana Vitae is Still Right.
Awesome. You can find them. I can't wait to get it. Thank you, Dr. Janet Smith, for both of your time with us tonight and last week. It's been a joy having you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for having me both weeks.
Thank you. There she is, Dr. Janet Smith of Humana Vitae fame. Look her up. Google her and look her up.
Hello, this is international Catholic singer Anna Nuzzo, inviting you to join me and Father Dan Cambra of the Marian Fathers on a select international tour's Divine Mercy pilgrimage to Poland and the Czech Republic. It takes place in September of 2019, and we would love for you to join us. For more information, go to my website, annanuzzo.com. Thank you, and God bless.
Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.